Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back. It is Saturday. It is time to go into the vault for a classic Stuff to Blow Your Mind episode. This one is going to be an episode we did on jumping and flying fish after Robert saw some leaping mullets in Florida. Was it Florida?
Yeah, I believe it was at Wakulla Springs. This is one of several episodes that ended up being I think both of us have had episodes that have been inspired by vacations.
Yeah.
We go out into the world, we relax a little bit, we learn something, and then we come back and we want to podcast on it. And in this case, I said, let's podcast about jumping fish. Trust me, it's more interesting than it sounds. And it is.
We never end up doing like the science of margaritas. No, wait a minute. I think maybe you went on vacation and then we did the science of cocktails. Is that right?
I don't know if that was vacation related, but it was certainly based on interest in cocktails.
Well,
no, that was a Christmas gift inspired one. I received books about cocktails for Christmas.
Okay.
And then I was like, hey, let's do an episode on this.
Well, the jumping fish episode turned out to be a lot more interesting of a topic than I might have expected going in. So I thought this one was a lot of fun, and we are happy to bring it back to you. This originally aired Thursday, July 14th, 2016, and here it is again for your listening pleasure.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. So, Robert, I know that recently you were on vacation somewhere.
I was, yeah. I went down to Florida with the family, and on the way back up, we stopped at this place called Wakulla Springs. Wakulla Springs State Park in Florida, near Tallahassee. Ended up just being really delightful.
Yeah, what's this place like?
Basically, what you have here is just an enormous spring, okay?
Like a geological spring.
Yeah.
Water coming out of the ground.
Yeah, water coming out of the ground. Water coming out of just enormous caverns that are under the water here. Really clear water. And it maintains a constant temperature of around 69 or 70 degrees. So when winter comes, it's a haven for manatees and especially manatees, but other creatures too that want that constant temperature.
Uh-huh.
Interestingly enough, they filmed a few scenes from the creature from the Black Lagoon there.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and particularly the creature's lair. You get to pass by that if you take these boat tours. And that's really the main reason to go. You can swim there, but you get to go on these really cool boat tours where you get to see all of these crazy estuary species doing their thing, all the like, diving birds,
Gators,
you know, laying in the sun by the dozens, get to see manatees. And you also get to see these mullets, the fish mullet, not the the hairstyle.
You probably saw some of those.
I think I did see a traditional hairstyle mullet here or there. But yeah, these are the fish, and they're just leaping out of the water. It's like you look around, you expect to see like a Disney princess wading around. Like that's how active the wildlife is here.
Uh-huh.
And but it really makes you think, like, why are these creatures, why are these fish jumping out of the water? If you're like me and you didn't have a lot of preconceived notions or you hadn't researched it before, you might think, oh, well, there are all sorts of animals around here. There are gators in the water. They're probably jumping out of the water to escape predators, right?
Yeah, that makes pretty easy sense. A lot of the maneuvering you'd see in a fish, especially a prey species, would be fleeing behavior. Mm-hmm.
And yet, it turns out there's more to it than that. And not only with mullets, but with other species of fish as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason we're having this episode, to discuss some of the mysteries, some of the theories, some of the, at times, myths surrounding leaping fish, fish that actually throw themselves out of the water, out of their habitat, their aquatic habitat, into this strange alien world of gases and vapors.
Yeah, when you think about it, it is so weird. It's hard for us to imagine what it's like crossing this boundary between mm-hmm. worlds from the water up into the land of gas, into the atmosphere, because it's not exactly like a terrestrial animal diving into the water.
Right.
Because when you jump out of the water is your natural environment, gravity is always going to be pulling you back down into this watery world. Plus, there's just so much more going on underwater than there is going on in the air. I mean, on the land is one thing, but you know, think about what most of the air above the water is like. It's a void. Under the water is another ecosystem. Leaping into the air is almost as if terrestrial animals could briefly leap into outer space.
Yeah. Or at least makes me think of the part in Phantasm where they go through like the Stargate into mm-hmm. the barren world where the dwarves are hauling stuff around. It's like zipping out of your world into another and then coming back into your world, perhaps in a different location, making it kind of like that teleport that the Raiden character does in the first couple of Mortal Kombat games. You know?
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
What does he say when he teleports, or does he have one?
He says when he does the Superman, but I don't remember if he says anything when he teleports, but maybe he should.
He just grins and has lightning come out of his eyes. What he should do, I hope someday somebody goes back to the first Mortal Kombat game and dubs in Christopher Lambert's lines from the movie.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot that he played Raiden in the first one.
Uh-huh.
But back to leaping fish.
Yeah. So, Robert, knowing your inquisitive nature, I bet you asked somebody at the park about the mullet jumping behavior, didn't you?
I did. And the park ranger was very insightful in all of this and mentioned that there are a handful of theories here. Okay. And the idea that they're escaping predators is not one of them. Mm-hmm. So one is that they may jump to dislodge parasites. And certainly aquatic life is full of many strange parasite removal strategies, including allowing cleaner organisms to crawl into your body, right?
Wait, what? Allowing cleaner organisms?
Oh, you've seen
I see. Yeah. You mean an organism that does cleaning, not a relatively cleaner organism.
No. Yeah, I'm talking like allowing
dirty
a small
parasites.
Shrimp to climb into your gills or your mouth in order to eat these things.
Right.
Even allowing creatures from the air to come down and feast on your parasites. I believe it's the sunfish that does that, allows certain birds to help remove its parasites.
That's fantastic. Now, can you imagine if every time we got like a guinea worm or something like that, we could just leap into outer space to try to fix it?
Well, that sounds kind of ridiculous. And indeed, that's one of the criticisms against this theory. Broadly speaking, concerning fish, because you see that thrown out a lot with jumping fish. Oh, it's a parasite removal strategy.
Uh-huh.
But critics of this theory will point out that, hey, parasites, once they get in you, they have ways of lodging themselves where they want to be.
Right.
Just merely a frantic leaping through the air is not going to dislodge them.
Okay. Well, then what are the other theories?
Well, the crazier theory, and this is one that I find really interesting, is that mullets spend a lot of their time in waters that are low in dissolved oxygen. Mm. And so they may exit the water in order to clear their gills and expose themselves to higher levels of oxygen. So that really blew my mind, the idea that essentially the fish is coming out of the water to breathe and then returned
to these
waters.
But that's not how fish breathe.
I know, but this is one of the theories. Wow. They also may jump during spawning season to break open their egg sacs in preparation for the spawn. Hmm. And marine biologist Dr. Grant Gilmore thinks it may come down to their sometimes dark habitats. They may jump in these cases to let others in the school know where they are.
Ah, so in this case, it would be a form of communication or social signaling, which comes up later in this episode.
Yes.
With some of the other jumping fish.
Indeed.
We're going to talk about, some of the more ferocious ones. All right, so for the rest of this episode, we're going to be looking at some of these, some of the most interesting fish jumping behaviors around the world. And I want to say that I found this topic way more interesting than I expected to. I was like, okay, what is there to say about fish jumping? They jump. But fish jumping can be very strange, can be a danger, can be a nuisance, can be very funny. And the reasons why they do it are more mysterious in some cases than I would have guessed. But, okay, so I guess we should start broadly. What do we know about, in general, why fish jump?
Well—
one more thing. Yes. I should say. We should specify, you all out there, you know the difference between a fish and a mammal. So you've seen dolphins jump playing in the waves or at a dolphin show or maybe just playing Echo the Dolphin. We're not talking about mammals today. This is going to be a fish-focused episode.
Yeah, I mean, there's even a gliding squid that propels itself out of the ocean by shooting out a jet of water at a high-pressure water jet.
Uh-huh.
We're not going to get into that either.
Okay.
But if there's enough demand, we'll save other leaping sea life for other episodes.
Okay.
But, yeah, I think a good place to start is just to sort of go back to this idea that, okay, fish jump out of the water to escape predators and acknowledge that, yes, this actually is a strategy with some creatures.
Sure.
For instance, killifish. Mm-hmm. Now, there are roughly 1,270 different species of killifish, and most are fully aquatic with no obvious morphological specializations for terrestrial locomotion. Individuals from several different species have been observed moving across land, though, via a tail flip behavior that generates a terrestrial jump.
Wait a minute. So this isn't just jumping into the air. This is jumping onto a dry land surface.
Yeah, it's essentially, it's getting too dangerous in the water. I got to jump out.
Uh-huh.
And then flop back in. And they do this to escape predators or occasionally apparently poor water conditions.
Okay, so in our outer space analogy, this is more like instead of just briefly leaping into outer space, if things got really hairy wherever you were, you could jump onto the moon for a minute and then jump back down somewhere on Earth.
Yeah, or taking like a proposed space tourism flight that just sends you into low orbit and then brings you back down.
Uh-huh.
Be that kind of thing, I think. But indeed, kind of like Raiden's teleport, where he's blinking out of this world, I guess going to some godland, and then coming back into the picture somewhere else. And this is interesting because that the aquatic amphibious distinction is key, because it's one thing for, say, an air-breathing, walking catfish, for mud skippers or lungfish to behave in this way, because they've taken things to the next level, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bordering on, Creature from the Black Lagoon or Bloodwaters of Dr. Z territory.
Right.
But aquatic fish, that just seems crazy, right? The tail flip flings them out of the water, through the air, several body lengths, sometimes out of the water and onto the bank, and then they have to flip to get back in.
Sounds dangerous, though. I mean, if you're a fish, you flip out of the water, and then you rapidly twist your body around to try to flip back into the water. I mean, you've only got a very limited amount of time there, right?
Right, yeah, because the big risks here are that you could dry out. Or you could asphyxiate.
Mm-hmm.
And you're, of course, also banking on the idea that there are no terrestrial predators on the water bank. So that's the killifish.
Yeah.
What else do we have? Take us to the next level here with our leaping aquatic creatures.
Well, I want to talk, Robert, about an Asian carpnado.
Ooh, sounds good.
Okay, so stop me if you've seen this YouTube video before. You got two passengers sitting in a boat. They're in twin seats facing off the stern of a fishing boat with an outboard motor.
Is this Godfather 2?
No, no, no.
Okay.
This is a grainy YouTube video.
Okay, I'm misremembering the
set
scene.
Set to some slick nu metal riffs. Now, the boat appears to be sitting in like a river or a lake. It's opaque, fresh water. And each of the two passengers sitting facing off the back of the boat are holding a compound hunting bow with a nocked arrow. And the driver then throttles up the engine. The boat starts to move and these lines of white churning wake peel out the back of the boat. And you can see the waves coming out. And as this happens, dozens of fish, or maybe hundreds of fish, begin to leap out of the water into the air. By the looks of it, sometimes flying above the heads of the passengers, and they arc over the boat. Sometimes they fly right into somebody's neck and slap them on the face. A fish hits you in the back, or it lands flopping in the driver's lap. And as you would expect, based on the setup, the passengers try to shoot the fish with their arrows as they leap through the air. In other similar videos, you might scratch the bow and arrow and feature just nets, people trying to catch the fish with nets, or shooting at them with shotguns, trying to hit them with baseball bats, or maybe a modified baseball bat with nails in it, pitchforks, etc.
Okay.
I might add that in the very first video I watched that I mentioned, the one with the compound bow, it was sort of this fish-human collision supercut with the nu metal background music. It looks pretty dangerous, especially because there are sometimes other boats in the water downrange of the bowfishers, so we are not recommending this behavior.
Yeah, it sounds a bit reckless.
But what's going on here? Why are these hundreds of fish flying through the air to be shot? I need a better metaphor than like fish in a barrel, like fish in outer space.
Yeah.
Well, the video identifies these very unfortunate vaulting fish as Asian carp, and I can't confirm the identification through all the graininess, but this would make sense because some species of so-called Asian carp are known for this bizarre, frenzied jumping behavior in the presence of boats. So what are Asian carp? Asian carp is not one species, but it's a common group name applied to several species of carp native to East and Southeast Asia, including waterways of Siberia, China, and Vietnam. And these species would be bighead carp, black carp, grass carp, and silver carp. So carp belong to the freshwater fish family known as cyprinids, and before the Asian carp were introduced a couple decades ago, there were already carp in North America that were considered kind of a benign nuisance species. But several species now known as Asian carp were introduced to the United States in the 1960s and 70s, and originally they were contained. They were contained in southern aquaculture and sewage treatment enclosures, I think in Arkansas originally. Okay. I saw. And so the idea was that these imported carp would help control contaminants in these areas. For example, they'd swim around and eat algae out of ponds that were being used as fish farms, like for catfish farming. But flooding events, of course, often connect waters that are not inherently connected. And so flooding allowed these non-native species to escape their farms and enclosures and spread into natural waterways around the Mississippi watershed. And now they're all over the place. They're spread all over freshwater fisheries in the Midwest and beyond. They're in the Mississippi. They're in the Illinois River. And a lot of people are worried about these and consider them an invasive species since they can represent a threat to native wildlife. They reproduce quickly. They grow quickly. They supposedly degrade the quality of aquatic environments, and they tend to outcompete other fish. And I've seen estimates that they can – some of these species consume about 20% of their own body weight every day. But they don't necessarily prey on other fish. Instead, they're mostly plankton and algae feeders, which still is a big problem because that's the bottom of the food chain, right? Mm. That's what everything has to eat in order to work its way up the food chain and get that energy to survive. So they're causing problems for every organism everywhere along the line. So why do they jump? Well, the bighead carp and the silver carp can both jump, but it's the silver carp in particular that's just notorious for frequently having these frenzies where they leap out of the water all over the place. And the commonly accepted explanation for why they do it is pretty simple. It's the main one that came to your mind when you were thinking about the mullet first. It's that they're scared. They're leaping out of the water as an escape mechanism triggered by a threatening stimulus like the roar of a boat motor. So somebody revs up their engine, they get their arrows knocked, and the fish hear that sound, and they start leaping all over the place. And once one starts leaping, all of them start leaping. So that sounds like a pretty funny situation, and I will admit, seeing these images of fish just flapping all over the place through the air, slapping people in the back of the head, leaving a big slimy streak across somebody's like chin and throat as they slap up under there. It sounds funny, but when you think about what it's actually like to be in the middle of it, it can get kind of scary because the bighead and silver carp are known to jump about 3 meters or about 10 feet vertically out of the water, about 6 meters or 20 feet horizontally across the surface. Silver carp tend to weigh up to about 20 pounds. Bighead carp commonly weigh about twice that. But in rare cases, these fish can reportedly grow very large, up to around 100 pounds. So think of like a 100-pound object flying at you out of the water, especially if you're moving at a rapid speed. Also, just do the quick Newtonian physics in your head. That can be a heavy impact. Now, I found one survey of people who used the Illinois River in 2010 and 2011, and it was a small sample size, so don't read too much into this. But it found – this was hilarious to me – 65% of residents from these Illinois River sites who used the river had seen Asian carp jump. Okay. But of those people who'd seen a carp jump, almost three quarters of them had been hit by a carp. So if you've seen a carp jump, chances are a carp has slammed into you. 9% of them sustained injuries and 15% reported sustained watercraft damage from the Asian carp. And there's just one example I want to give of the kinds of injuries these things can cause. I found a KTVI local news story from St. Louis from last year, August of 2015, and it tells the story of this guy named Jordan Fiedler, who got his face messed up real bad by some Asian carp while inner tubing along a channel in the Mississippi. So according to the story, his father was driving the boat, and he was riding in an inner tube behind it, and then the fish start leaping. They jump up all over the place, and one hits him in the face. And a quote he gave is, quote, "I knew something was wrong. I felt my nose, and it was way over here." Ugh. So the impact fractured his nose, it dented his forehead, shattered bones in his eye sockets and above his eyebrow, and he had to undergo a 3.5-hour surgery to install a piece of mesh and screws to fix the shape of his skull.
So this is no small injury. This is a devastating fish impact.
If nobody has made a Jaws-style movie about carp yet, about the leaping carp, I think they should. Well, this is the real Sharknado, except it's not a shark. This is Carpnado.
Well, hopefully, I'm really hoping someone will take this whole episode as inspiration, and maybe it'll be an overall just jumping fish horror movie. All the various examples we throw out here.
It's the fish version of the birds, maybe.
Yeah, the fishes. The fish.
Weirdly, though, as mundane as carp may seem, they actually also have a mythological significance. I bet you didn't think that we'd wrap some mythology into this episode, but it's
I didn't even think about it. And normally I'm all about finding it. I didn't even think to look.
Well, apparently the jumping ability of carp has a cultural and slight mythological significance in Chinese tradition. So there's a story in Chinese mythology of carp swimming upstream. And that if a carp swimming upstream is able to jump over a waterfall that's known as the Dragon Gate, that carp will transform into a dragon. And with that comes all of the symbolic uplift that applies, right? Mm. You know, the dragon is a majestic, regal creature associated with power and with grandeur and with the imperial authority, basically.
And flight.
Yes, and flight. There you go. So apparently the expression of, quote, "a carp that jumps over the Dragon Gate" commonly signifies a person who accomplishes some feat that leads to like a sudden improvement in life status, such as passing exams at university or acquiring some coveted government position. It's like if you get a major life upgrade due to some achievement of yours, you are a carp who has jumped the Dragon Gate. And hopefully not smash anybody's face on the way.
All right. Well, everyone keep that myth in mind because I feel like we're going to get back to some of these ideas with some of our later examples. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to look at salmon, we're going to look at swordfish, we're going to look at sturgeons, and ultimately the flying fish itself. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O Allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
All right, we're back.
Okay, so before the break, we were talking about the mythological symbology of carp, swimming upstream, trying to leap over that waterfall and turn into a mighty dragon. But of course, carp are not the only fish that struggle mightily to progress upstream against a current, even leaping over rapids and waterfalls.
Yeah, indeed. What is one of the most iconic images of leaping fish? Like a perfect nature documentary image.
It's the salmon. It's the salmon going upstream to spawn, leaping over the rapids, and a bear just grabbing one. You know what I mean?
Yeah, indeed.
That's the bear version of the people trying to hit a carp with a baseball bat with nails in it. It's just the bear's claw swiping at the salmon as it flies over the rapids.
Yeah, this is... So let's break down exactly what's happening here. because it's pretty amazing. It's easy to take it for granted when you've seen it so many times. Yeah. But salmon spend their early lives in freshwater rivers, and then they swim out to sea, to the salt water, to feed and grow. But when spawning time comes, they engage in what we call a salmon run, and what grizzly bears, of course, call like a seafood buffet. I guess. So the fish travel upstream to their natal spawning grounds. They spawn and then they die, and then the nutrients in their bodies wash downstream to the estuaries. So it's kind of an elegant practice here. Mm-hmm. But making it upstream is quite a journey, especially when you're having to deal with rapids and waterfalls. No dragon gates, but still some significant challenges there.
Right.
And so they leap out of the water. They jump sometimes up to 12 feet or 3.65 meters. Now, not only they have to contend not only with bears, but also man. Humans have shown a tremendous ability, of course, to alter natural waterways, to install dams, bridges, what have you.
Oh, yeah. This is actually figured into people trying to control the spread of carp, like silver carp, the jumping carp in American waterways. So you've got these carp moving slowly upstream. And to prevent them from spreading even further, some people have said, well, we need to construct barriers of some kind. But these have to be some pretty tall barriers, right? Because these things can, jump 10 feet high and 20 feet long. So that would have to be a serious barrier to prevent the carp from progressing.
Yeah. And then what do you do about other creatures that have a natural right? Are you going to install like a border guard to keep the carp out but make sure the right creatures move through? I don't know.
It's tough. I saw one solution that was literally an electrified fence in the water.
Oh, wow.
Where people installed little devices that put electrical current in the river to prevent the carp from swimming by.
Hmm. Well, with the salmon, in the case of dams and other structures, we actually sometimes create fish ladders or fishways to help them out.
Yeah.
And these can be quite interesting because sometimes they essentially look like nothing more than a series of buckets that they can splash and jump in and out of to actually make it over whatever the obstacle is.
Yeah, a watery staircase of sorts.
But it's a cool idea because as we pointed out, like not only is it important for the salmon to actually reach their destination, but it actually, their ultimate death up there ends up playing an important role in the overall ecology of the river.
Isn't this also why the salmon cannon was invented?
Yes, I believe so.
It was to help the salmon get upstream. I don't remember whatever became of that.
Yeah, I don't know if that became a standard or if that was just kind of a flash in the pan.
Uh-huh. All right, so one thing that comes to my mind is that, of course, a carp can jump up out of the water, hit you in the face, and that can cause some injury. But there are also fish much bigger than carp that do jump.
That's right. And some of them jump with tremendous speed.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, of course, about the mighty swordfish.
Okay.
Which its scientific name is Xiphias gladius, which basically is just the word sword repeated in two different languages. So, basically we're so excited about swordfish looking like a human murder weapon that we just call them sword.
It's like a little kid. Sword.
Yeah. And, of course, they're just... It's basically just a bill. They are billfish. There are other billfish with bills that resemble swords. Others resemble bills. Sometimes they look like saws.
Yeah.
There are a number of different species. And interestingly enough, evidence seems to support the theory that the pointy end is more about speed than anything.
So it's not a weapon. It's more of an aerodynamic design.
Right. There's actually a weak point in the skull where the sword meets the skull, and it prevents them from being a proper javelin. Like if they were to hit something at too great a speed, it would just snap. And the weak point is due to a lubricating gland that reduces drag and increases speed. Like it basically pumps out oil. It spreads out through vessels, pumps out this lubricant that lubricates the sword and the thing's whole head, that allows it to just sort of slip through the water a little bit faster.
So before the swordfish races, they're sitting there lubing up their swords.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah.
And there, I think there are still some arguments that it may, to certain degrees, have some sort of defensive capability as well, especially if you're talking about a slashing as opposed to a full-on, ramming speed type of a stabbing maneuver.
But it might be a secondary use or you use it in a pinch.
Yeah, because it certainly can be dangerous, as we'll discuss here. But the speed's the big thing. And indeed, swordfish are generally ranked like the third fastest fish. They're only surpassed by the black marlin and the sailfish, both of which are other types of billfish.
Well, how fast?
Swordfish, the estimates vary on all of these, and people will get into fights over exact speeds.
Yeah.
But generally, you're looking at the black marlin, it clocked around possibly 80 miles per hour.
No,
129.
No way.
Yeah, 129 kilometers per hour.
That's like twice as fast as your average boat can go.
Yeah, but then again, these are creatures that are living in the open water. They're dealing with vast distances, so they have room to build up that speed. Sailfish, 69 miles per hour, 110, and the swordfish comes in at a more conservative 60 miles per hour, 97 kilometers per hour. But again, people will argue back and forth on these stats.
No, that's still amazingly fast considering the water. I mean, when you think about moving through water, all the friction that's there, I mean, it's crazy.
And they've evolved to deal with that friction just about as well as any sea animal is going to manage.
Uh-huh.
Of course, they're also known to use that intense speed to hurl themselves completely out of the water. Now, why? One of the things about swordfish in particular is that they're rare creatures. They're elusive creatures. And they don't do well in captivity, so it's hard to really study them and their ways. But they are susceptible, like everything else, to parasites. So there is a theory that they may be trying to dislodge parasites. In particular,
what would these parasites be?
In particular, the paper I was looking at mentioned remoras, which are of course sucker fish that feed on other ectoparasites.
Okay.
So essentially, these things might be bothering them. At the very least, they're screwing with their streamlined body, right? They're messing up their speed potentially. So perhaps they're jumping out trying to dislodge those remoras. Or if they have a sports fisherman's hook in them, well, that's something they're probably trying to dislodge as well.
Yeah.
And that's certainly the iconic scene, right? Somebody gets a swordfish on the hook and it's leaping out of the water.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can see that at a much lower level. Just imagine, you've probably seen footage of a bass fisher or something like that with a bass on the line and it jumps out of the water.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I know the question on everybody's mind here. Has anybody ever been impaled by a swordfish, by the sword?
Yes.
The sword.
Yes, indeed they have. Now, It's a rare occurrence, just as these human interactions with swordfish are already kind of a rare thing, right?
Yeah.
People fish for them, but still, they're elusive.
So this isn't something to get really worked up about.
Right. You're probably going to be putting yourself in the position to have the outside chance of this occurring. But as of 2007, there were no recorded attacks, and I put that in quotes because these are not creatures that eat humans or would seemingly attack humans. Any incidents seem to have been more or less accidental.
Right.
But as of 2007, there were no recorded attacks that had actually resulted in death, though the paper in question, Swordfish Attack, Death by Penetrating Head Injury, did outline one such incident. And then in 2015, a deep-sea fishing charter captain in Hawaii was fatally stabbed in the chest by one while trying to capture it with a spear gun. So basically it thrashed around after the spear hit the fish, and then it managed to skewer him in the chest and killed him. So it's a rare occurrence, but with a sword like that, with a large fish flopping around, jumping out of the water, if you're close to it, yes, you run the risk of being run through.
Right. But even in this one incident mentioned here, it sounds like this guy was kind of, I don't want to say he was asking for it, but
he put him, well, basically, he just put himself in close proximity to a large, sharp fish.
Yeah.
And you're rolling the die when that happens, right?
Right. You don't wrestle with a unicorn.
Exactly.
But then again, of course, there are other very large fish that jump as well. In fact, as we saw with the carp example, you don't need a spike or a sword in order to do some damage when you run into somebody.
Right. All you need is a high-powered recreation vessel and a 100-pound carp, perhaps.
Yeah.
But what if it was even bigger? What if you were talking, instead of a 100-pound carp, what if you were talking about, say, Florida's Gulf sturgeon, which, if you've ever seen a sturgeon in an aquarium, these they look like an armored tank or something. You know, they're rather intimidating. And then they get huge. They can come in at the Florida Gulf sturgeon in particular can come in at 8 feet long, 2.5 meters, and up to 200 pounds or 91 kilograms in weight. And yes, they sometimes jump out of the water, up to 6 feet out of the water. And occasionally, that we're not only talking the risk of injury here, there have been lethal occurrences of sturgeon impacts.
Oh, man. Well, I got to hear about that in a second. But this is weird to me because maybe I assume sturgeon must be able to move fast if this is the case. But I've never seen a sturgeon move quickly. I've seen sturgeon in aquariums, and they always seem incredibly chilled out and very languid fish, just hanging there. I mean, barely moving at all.
Yeah, it is. I have to admit that too. Like seeing them in aquariums, they're always really interesting, kind of intimidating, but very still.
Yeah.
But yeah, they jump. In 2015, in fact, one of these jumping sturgeons actually killed a 5-year-old girl when it leapt out of the water into her family's fishing boat. And it also injured her mother and her brother as well. In 2007, 9 people were injured in a collision with a sturgeon, resulting in warning signs that were posted to encourage slower motorboat and jet ski speeds. So, yeah, you have a 200-pound fish flying out of the water, up to 6 feet out of the water. And then you have a motorboat, you know, moving at high speeds as well. That's where these possibilities present themselves.
Okay, but a fish this big, why do they jump out of the water?
Well, it's remained a bit of a mystery. But we have a few familiar theories as well as one that's kind of new here for our discussion here. So, first of all species of sturgeon will jump at times. The Gulf sturgeon is known to jump at 2 different times of the year in the rivers during July and August and early in the offshore feeding period. So one theory is they do it to escape predators, but
That's a big fish.
It's a big fish.
How many predators do they have?
Exactly. It's kind of a lame theory because the larger sturgeon do not have predators. Another theory is that they do it for fun. And this is one I see mentioned with dolphins, and maybe we'll save that one for another discussion.
Well, I don't want to be unfairly prejudiced against the intellectual capabilities of fish, because as we learned with our birds episode, sometimes you underestimate what other animal minds are capable of. But I tend to think of play as something that's more associated with more complex mammalian nervous systems, which is why it makes sense with dolphins, you know, kind of intelligent mammals. Fish, I don't know, are they mentally complex enough to play?
Yeah, I mean, plus it's also, it comes down to economics. I was reading some thoughts on this from biologist Ken Sulak, and he pointed out that jumping, especially for a massive sturgeon, it's an energy expenditure, so there has to be a trade-off in behavioral importance, you know, beyond mere fun. He actually theorizes that this is a form of communication with sturgeons. So when they jump out and splash, it creates a distinct sound, a slapping noise. But they also create a small sound before and after the jump. It's kind of like they produce kind of like clicks and drumming noises. So it's kind of a click or a drumming noise, the jump, the splash, another sound. And he thinks that they might be announcing their presence and position to the larger group. So it's like the mooing of a cow.
Wow.
Which I think is an interesting theory.
Well, this does this communication theory plays into something that I'm going to mention later, especially when we talk about sharks.
Yes, and we'll get to sharks in a minute. But before we do, we have another potentially dangerous, perhaps even more worrisome for half our listeners, fish to contend with.
Okay, so you may have heard this story. A man is walking in the jungles of the Amazon.
Okay.
And he realizes that, oh, man, I had so much coffee this morning. I need to evacuate some urine.
Okay. Yes, you do.
So he wades knee-deep into the waters of the river, and he unzips and begins to relieve himself into the water.
Question. Why does he wade into the water before he urinates?
I had that same question, but this is how the story often goes.
All right.
So for a few seconds, this activity proceeds as normal. But then to his horror, he sees a tiny, barely perceptible shape leap from the surface of the water into his urethra.
Oh, okay.
In an alternate version of the story, it supposedly swims up the column of his urine stream and into his urethra. And then once inside there, it spreads this collection of barbed spines like an umbrella opening inside your urethra and just lodges itself there and begins to feast on the flesh. And eventually he either dies or he has to undergo a really, really undesirable surgery to get it removed.
Oh, well, that's horrible. I think we've all heard versions of this before. Right.
You may remember a version of this from some dialogue between Eric Stoltz and John Voight in the movie Anaconda.
Ah, okay. I vaguely remember that. I tend to remember the gross-out moments of that film more, but yes.
Oh, I mostly remember John Voight's accent. What is his accent supposed to be? It's like a cross between South American and Count Dracula. That's great. But is this story really true? Does anything like this happen? Can a tiny fish jump out of the water and into somebody's urethra or swim up your urine stream into your urethra? Well, the fish allegedly described in this story is agreed by most authorities to be, in fact, the Vandalia serosa, which is a type of parasitic catfish, also known as a vampire catfish. But it's commonly known in the sort of legendary literature as the candiru. These are the facts about Vandalia. So Vandalia is this tiny parasitic catfish, usually about an inch or 2 inches, you know, 2.5 to 5 centimeters long, nearly invisible in the water, especially when it hasn't fed recently. And it occupies the tropical freshwater rivers of South America, Amazon River Basin, and it drinks the blood of other fish. So its regular MO is you're a goldfish or something like that, swimming around in the river. And the candiru, or the Vandalia scientifically, swims into your gills and anchors itself there with spines that line its gill covers. And then it drinks your blood. It becomes engorged, and then it swims away to the bottom to burrow in and digest.
The bottom of the waterway.
Right.
Okay.
And so when it enters the gills of the host fish, it bites at an aorta artery, ventral or dorsal, and it doesn't need to suck because actually the host's blood pressure just pumps blood into the candiru's mouth. So instead of blood sucking, this animal is more like when you hook the lip of a balloon over a water faucet and then turn the water on to make a water balloon. Mm-hmm. It's just letting itself fill up.
Okay. So the idea here is that if it preyed on humans, obviously swimming into someone's pee hole is not its design.
No.
It would be like a pork tapeworm getting lost and winding up in your brain.
Right.
It doesn't need that to happen, but it occurs accidentally.
Right. This is a mistake for this animal if this is true, and it's a fatal mistake for the animal and sometimes for the person, according to the story. So those are the facts I just reported. Now, there are also a bunch of claims that are commonly reported as fact, and these include that the candiru can swim up the urethra of a person or mammal that might urinate in the water. So the less unbelievable version is that mammals wade fully into the water and begin to urinate once under the water, and the candiru swims up one of their orifices, the urethra or the vagina or the anus. It's commonly reported that this fish is attracted to the flow of urine, maybe because it's chemically similar to some chemicals that would come out of the gills of its host fish.
Mm-hmm.
More on that in a bit. And then once inside you, it gets stuck, can't escape, dies, obstructs the path of the urethra, you can't pee, and it has to get removed by surgery. Classical stories of this include lots of accounts of penile amputation. So you can see why this causes extreme distress for people getting into these waters.
Yeah, and I can also see why a lot of this is sort of hinged on just creating a cringy, hard tale to share with visitors. Say, yeah. Oh, the fish will swim up your pee hole and then we'll have to cut your penis off. And,
right.
You know, so it's easy to see it as nothing more than that.
Yeah. So there are two questions here. Number one is the general one. Do candiru actually swim up people's urethras?
Mm-hmm.
And if so, do they perform this even more crazy sounding feat of either jumping from the water, this jumping fish tie in here?
Which isn't as crazy based on what we've been discussing. Lots of fish jump. So
sure.
It seems possible. Now, could it jump with such a degree of accuracy
that it jumps straight into your urethra? That's kind of tough to imagine. Or the even crazier one, that it swims up the stream of your urine. I got some doubts about that. But
yes.
Are there any medical cases of this, in the cases in the medical literature? Well, there's one major report
in the modern day that people refer to. So in 1997, a urogenital surgeon named Anwar Samad, who was working in Amazonia in Brazil, reportedly extracted a dead candiru from a patient's penis. And according to the report of the patient's story, the patient was standing thigh deep in the water, urinating into the water with his penis above the water. And he reported that the fish jumped out of the water, swam up the stream of his urine and into his urethra. Now, I as I alluded to earlier, I'm really suspicious about the physics of the swimming up the urine stream.
Yeah, it also makes me wonder if he did have something lodged in his urethra. Like maybe he only became aware of it when he urinated, and he just happened to be standing in the water, and he made the assumption that that's when it entered.
Yeah, so we only have this second or I guess third hand report in this case, so it's hard to know exactly what happened. But imagine the idea, like physically, just try to think of the fluid mechanics of swimming up a stream of urine. It'd be kind of like if you had. Imagine a really good swimmer, like an Olympic swimmer, in a pool, and then you stand on the roof of a house over the pool and aim a fire hose at them and say, okay, swim up the stream of the fire hose to me. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to make any sense.
It'd be like swimming up a waterfall.
Right.
Salmon do not swim up a waterfall.
But they can jump.
They can jump over it.
Right. Yeah. So I can believe it's much more likely that a fish simply jumped out of the water and in this one in a million chance kind of way happened to jump straight into this guy's unfortunate urethra, which we should say does expand during urination.
That's true.
So yeah. It kind of opens the possibility there, both figuratively and, I guess, literally. So according to a BBC story I read on the candiru legend, the American marine scientist Stephen Spott met with Samad, the surgeon who supposedly removed the candiru from the guy in 1997, and he met with this guy in 1999 to investigate, and he was shown pictures and video of the extraction. So a real surgery definitely took place. Something was actually removed from this guy's urethra, and there was a preserved specimen of the fish itself. But Spott wasn't entirely convinced for a few reasons. One was the physical mechanical problem I just mentioned in the patient's story. The other was the preserved specimen was a lot bigger than you'd expect a candiru to grow, which in one other source I read, it was more than 5 inches long and almost half an inch wide.
Oh, God.
Can you? The problem is it was bigger than the thing we'd expect to find in your urethra.
That also makes the story all the more horrific to envision.
Yeah. And then the specimen also, according to Spott, did not show signs of having been lodged or removed as described. For example, it didn't have snipped off spines or anything. Then again, Spott reported that he didn't entirely dismiss the account either. At this point, many elements appear unlikely, but it's hard to know what really happened. But as a side note, this sort of raises the question of candiru entering the urethra and other body orifices more generally, right? So this has been widely reported as fact all throughout the literature, both scientific and popular, for a couple hundred years now. But a few critical writers have pointed out these accounts are kind of weird. Like they're almost always vague and secondhand. It happened to somebody that I heard of somewhere up the river. Some guy in the next village had a candiru swim or jump into his penis and get lodged there. And also, supposedly, one of the explanations for this, that the candiru are attracted to the chemicals commonly found in human urine, such as urea, that has been tested and found to be completely without merit. So Stephen Spott, along with the guy I mentioned earlier, along with colleagues Paulo Petri and Jensen Zonon, published results of an experiment in 2001 that found that Vandelia, these parasitic catfishes, under lab conditions just didn't care about the chemical attractants in the water at all. They were not interested in ammonia, amino acids, fresh fish slime, or human urine. No response. They just didn't care. Instead, they seemed to hunt for hosts such as Amazon goldfish, mostly by sight. They saw them and said, those look like some good gills. I'm going to them. And fortunately, somebody has actually tried to figure out if there's anything to all these stories. There's a paper in the Journal of Travel Medicine in 2013 by Irmgard Bauer called "Candiru: A Little Fish with Bad Habits. Need Travel Health Professionals Worry? A Review." And so in this paper—
The least scandalous possible headline for
this. I know, but Bauer essentially concluded that there's
probably nothing to these stories. There was an extensive review of all the available literature, and there's just not strong evidence that these fish pose a threat to humans. Instead, the record sort of indicates that these attacks are just always hearsay. The same stories get repeated over and over as if they're fact. Mm-hmm. And Bauer concludes by saying, you know, considering the range of this fish, it's all over the place, and how horrifying their habit is supposed to be, it seems like, wouldn't we be hearing about this more often in the modern day? Wouldn't we be encountering stories of this happening? There's almost nothing. There's just like those old stories that have been repeated for decades, and then there's this one disputable 1997 case.
Yeah, I mean, the only counter argument I can think of is that since it's like a penile injury, that it would be underreported out of shame or embarrassment, but not if you factor in like the supposed severity of the infection. You know,
so. I feel like this is the kind of thing that if there were a confirmed case where somebody went to a hospital, mm-hmm. and this was, you know, became part of the medical literature, this would be all over IFL Science and everything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Everybody would be like, oh, my God, a guy got a fish up his penis. We've got to report the heck out of this.
Yeah. Yeah. And we just don't see that.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, there are plenty of other things that can harm your privates if you go waiting around in, you know, Amazonian rivers and
yeah,
whatnot.
In fact, that is part of the explanation, is that many of these stories may be sort of garblings, mm-hmm. Because a lot of them come from, you know, colonial periods in the Amazon and stuff like that, where there were language barriers between the people reporting the stories and then the people writing them down and publishing them. So I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of room for legend and error.
Yeah, plus, I mean, if anyone out there, if you've ever had a UTI, urinary tract infection, you know that it can feel like a tiny barbed fish has swam inside you.
Yeah.
So I could see where such uncomfortable scenarios could lend themselves to creative interpretations.
Right. Okay, so what do we think on that? Kandiru leaping into your urethra, not impossible, but seems unlikely.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver. And this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get into sharks, because I think we've all seen these stunning images, some photoshopped, of great white sharks
leaping over out. The Golden Gate Bridge.
leaping over bridges, or at least managing to get their entire bodies out of the water in a way that just terrifies us, because you look and you say, well, that's a monster of the water.
Right.
But it is not allowed out of the water. It is not allowed up here in the air, because that just messes with all of the guidelines that govern my safety.
Yeah, I thought I was supposed to be safe in this boat. Well, in keeping with our theme of fish leaping at people in their watercraft, did you know that sometimes even great white sharks leap into boats?
Entirely into both.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
So in this case, as with others, this is not a situation of attempted predatory behavior toward the humans on the boat. It's not an attack.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a very unfortunate coincidence. One example of this kind of story, July 2011, I found a National Geographic News story covering one of these events. So in July 2011, there's a research vessel off Seal Island off the coast of South Africa. And if you've seen videos of great white sharks jumping into the air out of the water, very likely that video came from around Seal Island in South Africa. This is one of the most famous places in the world to see this behavior among white sharks. So there's a research vessel in the waters out near this place, and a roughly 500 kilogram or half ton great white shark jumps into the boat operated by these marine researchers. And it's in the boat. It's stuck on the deck beneath the the walls in the boat. So it's thrashing around. Everybody had to get the heck away from it and try to figure out how to help it get back into the water so it wouldn't die. Robert, for your benefit, I have a picture here.
Oh, wow.
It's just a shark in the boat.
That is a big shark, too. Uh-huh. This is not, if you're picturing like just a juvenile, small little aquarium shark,
no,
you are wrong.
This is a huge shark. Yeah. So, of course, they couldn't get the shark out of the boat by hand. And so they attempted to drag it out with a rope, and that failed. And then eventually they had to drive the boat back to the harbor, and they tried to lift it out of the boat with a crane, which was dangerous to do, but the shark was going to die, so they had to try it. And they lowered it back into the water, but the shark, maybe confused or injured from this, stranded itself on a harbor beach nearby. They attempted to push it back into the water by hand, and that failed. So eventually they tied the animal to the side of a boat and drove it out to sea. And about half an hour after that, the shark swam away. It swam away and seemed to recover. It slapped its tail. So nobody knows what happened after that, if it eventually went on to live and be okay, or if it was injured and if it died. They're just not sure. But I hope that sharks out there right now longing for seal flesh.
Trying to eat Blake Lively.
Right. So when a shark leaps out of the water, this is known as breaching. And to use specific terminology that I love from one study that I read, when a shark leaps vertically or near vertically out of the water, so it's coming up from below, vertically into the air with a head up position, this is known as a Polaris breach.
Oh, I love that.
That's so good. That's a good band name. So why do sharks breach? Why do they come up out of the water like
well,
that?
Well, based on a lot of my research that concerns like 1980s Italian shark films that came out in the wake of Jaws, they do it to make a boat explode. Right.
Yeah, to smash a boat in half. No, that is not why they do it. There are two main kinds of breaching. There may be other minor behaviors, but the two main kinds that you'll read about most often are predatory breaching and what's known as natural breaching.
Okay.
So predatory breaching, it's all there in the name. The shark is in the pursuit of prey. There's a seal, you know, a pinniped there that's a nice, fatty, delicious, energy-rich meal swimming along near the surface of the water. And in these breaches, the shark moves rapidly up from below, bites as it shoots up into the air, and then slams back down into the water. And in a lot of cases there, it'll shoot up from below, hit the seal, bite it, and then release it, and then wait for the seal to bleed out and die and come back and finish it.
I was reading a paper about this the other day in preparation for this episode, and I found that interesting because I really had not researched actual shark predatory behavior much. Mm-hmm. And the idea that they wound and then allow the prey to bleed and then come back for it is interesting because because, you know, nobody wants to get slapped by a seal,
right?
Including a great white shark.
Yeah,
you
even
know?
The shark has to be cautious. Like, a prey can injure it if it's fighting around with it while the prey is still strong. So it wants to avoid that. In fact, one of the papers I read about this by an author named R. Aidan Martin, who has written on great white breaching a good bit, they actually put together a shark hunting decision tree.
Oh.
So it's like a flow chart where, you know, depending on what happens, do you move to this next thing or this next thing? And so it includes like the initial attack, and then do you catch or do you wait and pursue? Do you, quote, process? I love that. At some point, the shark begins to process the seal.
And we don't mean thinking about the seal here either.
No, this is sort of working on it, right?
Right.
Butchering with its mouth, basically. Mm-hmm. So why does it do this? Well, why is the great white shark attacking the seal in this way? Why didn't it just swim up from behind and bite it? Well, think about how this plays out in practice, like what the conditions are for the predator and for the prey. Looking up from the deep water below, the shark has more ability to see a seal near the surface than the seal does to see a shark. So the seal is illuminated by the sky, and these attacks take place more often in low light conditions when there's less penetration of water, of the water column by the light in the sky, like if the sun's at an angle.
Okay.
So you're a shark, you know, several, you know, meters down below the water, and you're looking up, you can see your prey, but it's less likely to see you, especially because of your dorsal coloring, the dark coloring on the top of you. And so why is this element of surprise so crucial? Well, when you look at the body composition of a white shark versus a seal, according to one study I read, between 94% and 97% of a white shark's muscle is composed of what's known as white muscle. And this is sprinting muscle. It's capable of rapid contraction, but it has very low stamina. And a pinniped, like a seal, on the other hand, can go the distance. It's capable of sustaining long-term evasive tactics. So the longer the attack goes on, the better, the less chance a shark has of catching the seal and getting it. So the sharks are better at sprinting than marathoning. Seals can keep evading. So a sudden surprise attack greatly increases the shark's chance of success. And this is why this rocketing up from below, which leads to breaching, is so common.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes perfect sense from from a hunting standpoint.
And according to a paper on the physics of this process, so the shark usually starts down deep in the water, a place where the bottom depth is between 26 and 30 meters. And in these cases, the entire attack, you know, leaping up from the bottom after they begin their strikes to the seal is about 2 to 2.5 seconds. So it just doesn't give the seal much time at all to react. And then, of course, at the speed it takes to hit the seal from below that fast, mm-hmm. the shark's still propelled upwards and it's going out of the water. And in these cases, the shark attacks are successful about 40 to 55% of the time, which is not a bad hunting success rate.
Yeah.
But then there's this other kind of breaching I mentioned.
Yeah.
That's the predatory breaching, jumping out of the water to kill. There's also what's known as natural breaching, when the shark breaches for no obvious reason. There's no predatory attack or anything.
No bait on the surface that it's being coaxed to the surface with.
Right. Yeah. So what's going on here? Well, according to one theory, sharks have these well-developed mechanoreceptors and chemoreceptors and electroreceptors. They have all kinds of, you know, receptive sensing organs that we don't have at that kind of level. So it's been hypothesized that tail slap, so that's one type of slapping behavior, and then mm-hmm. breaching, jumping out of the water and splashing down, are communicative. They're allowing sharks to communicate between one another through agonistic behaviors. That's, fighting displays.
Oh, like, okay.
I'm tough. This is my food. You better get away because I could fight you for it. And it's true that lots of fishes do use sound as a communication channel. And so it's hypothesized that these behaviors like tail slapping and breaching, jumping out of the water and splashing down, could exploit this kind of mechanoreception, this sound-sensitive ability of fish to communicate between the sharks. And when you think about it, a shark jumping out of the water and splashing down is not necessarily a bad signifier of fitness. That's like the bigger you are and the stronger you are, the harder of a splashdown you can make.
Yeah. It certainly, I mean, it makes a statement to us, and we're not even sharks.
Yeah, and one reason to think this is a good explanation is that this natural breaching often seems to happen with sharks in the presence of other sharks, not just hanging out by themselves.
Now, this is interesting. We're talking about this breaching behavior that's taking place, specifically the predatory breaching behavior.
Right.
It's taking place in the presence of these seals. Mm-hmm. You brought up an interesting tidbit yesterday about the recent shark movie, The Shallows,
yeah.
in which the shark tries to eat Blake Lively.
Yeah.
About what does it mean when we see a movie shark breaching like this in seemingly tropical waters?
Oh, yeah. This was interesting. I believe I read this. Now, this isn't in my notes. I'm just trying to recall from memory. Uh-huh. But I recall that I read this, I think, on Smithsonian.com.
Okay.
Where they were reviewing the trailer of the film, but they spoke to a marine biologist who had some knowledge of shark behaviors and said, okay, look at how the shark's acting in the trailer for this movie. Is this basically accurate? And I recall what the expert said was, well, it looks like this movie's supposed to take place in tropical waters, and yet you see the shark, when it attacks this guy, leaps out of the water. That's breaching behavior, which is not necessarily something you'd be likely to see in tropical waters, because the places you really see it are like in South Africa, where they have these prey like seals that they have to attack in this manner in order to maximize their success rate at catching them. In tropical waters, sharks probably have access to fish that are much more slow moving and easier to catch, and they don't have to resort to these breaching behaviors in order to catch meals.
Yeah.
So the expert they talked to rated that as not quite so plausible.
Yeah. But from a cinematic standpoint, nothing is more terrifying than the shark coming out of its habitat into our habitat in order to, especially to eat us.
It's the inherent perversity of the land shark.
It is. All right. Well, at this point, we really have only one sort of leaping, jumping fish to consider.
Right.
And that is, of course, the so-called flying fish.
Right. Because the distinction between jumping and flying may seem very clear to mm-hmm. you, right? You know, kangaroos jump and birds fly, and these are not all that similar behaviors. But the dividing line between them, I don't know. Is it really just time?
Well, yeah, you can certainly bog yourself down in definitions of flight.
Right.
To be clear, with the flying fish, we are talking about a gliding, sometimes kind of a hydroplaning, where the tail is still in contact with the water. So it's not powered flight. It's not true flight.
So we're not talking about Piranha 2, the spawning here.
Right. And then there are certainly no feathers involved. But it's interesting to put this in to sort of top off this discussion of all these leaping and jumping behaviors, because gliding fish might seem like the evolutionary pinnacle of jumping fish, right? But the interesting thing here is that they're nothing new at all. In 2012, paleontologists found a near complete skeleton from the Triassic period. That's 235 to 242 million years ago. And near complete skeleton boasted all the key attributes of the modern flying fish: well-developed pectoral fin and a forked asymmetrical tail.
Hmm.
And even this form seemed to have evolved independently from the 64 known species of flying fish we find today in all the world's oceans.
Independent. So it's not like an ancestor of them,
right?
Like a cousin of them that's now not here.
Right. It developed this gliding technique on its own. So it's interesting just to realize that gliding fish have evolved in the past separately. They've died out. And we have a fairly successful model of it today in these 64 known species of flying fish. And again, they don't necessarily fly as much as they glide, but they can really glide.
So then what would the difference be between a fish that glides and a fish that actually, quote, flies?
Well, again, this is an area where individuals can get into discussions and disagreements over what defines flight, but essentially it's the difference between powered flight and gliding.
Okay.
All right. So is the creature flapping its wings in order to sustain itself in the air, or is it merely sort of falling with grace, right?
Hang glider versus an airplane.
Exactly. Because we see plenty of gliding creatures, and it generally means in order to glide, you need to either fall from something high, such as a tree, which is why we see so many, tree-based gliders, arboreal gliders,
right,
or it needs to be able to jump up high enough to glide a little bit, and that's what we see with gliding or flying fish. And they can really glide. They can glide and or hydroplane distances of 1,300 feet or 400 meters in 30 seconds, with maximum flight speeds of up to 45 miles per hour or 72 kilometers per hour, which is pretty impressive. I feel like we've all seen like splendid videos of this taking place. It's pretty impressive.
So since these fish are small, I imagine they're not breaching to inflict predatory damage on a seal or something like that.
No. These are generally plankton eaters, and pretty much everybody agrees that they jump and glide to escape their many, many enemies in the sea.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yet another evasive maneuver.
Right. Now, there have been some that have proposed that this has to do with energy conservation, like the running or porpoising that is observed in marine mammals such as penguins or dolphins. But it really doesn't pan out when you crunch all the factors, including the oxygen debt of takeoff. And biologist John Davenport did just this sort of crunching in his 1994 paper, How and Why Do Flying Fish Fly?, which is certainly a good in-depth read if you really want to get into the economics and the physics of this. Another theory sees all of this as a means to move from a food or plankton poor area to a food-rich area, thus making the energy expenditure worth it, essentially kind of like Raiden teleporting during a fight to get behind an opponent. You're not in a good position for your food. Teleport to the positive position via flight.
Okay.
But there's not a lot of evidence to back that up. So
why would the flying or gliding in that case be better than just swimming to the food rich area?
I just have to go back to the Raiden analogy there. It's just it's in the realm of water, it is more like an instant appearance as opposed to a journey to.
Okay.
But again, so you can pretty much don't worry too much about that theory, because pretty much everybody is still in agreement. This is about escaping predators. Now, in escaping those predators, flying fish or gliding fish, they don't flap their wings to gain lift. They propel through the air-water interface. I like that terminology.
Right.
At a shallow angle, unfurl their large lateral fins, and then rapidly beat their tail in the water prior to actual liftoff. And it's interesting, too, that they have to be a certain size before they can actually pull this off. The smaller flying fish, before they've attained appropriate size, they can't actually pull this off. They're limited to simple leaps with their fins held against the body by surface tension.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so flying fish, you might say in this case, is kind of a misnomer then.
Yes.
They're gliding fish. We have jumping fish. We have longer jumping fish. We have gliding fish. But I wonder why no fish with the ability to maintain sustained flight. Mm-hmm. Because if you imagine the evolution of flight in its many forms, it's commonly hypothesized that flight organs began with gliding organs, you know, or organisms had maybe movements or gliding organs that would help them coast from one tree to another or help them escape a predator faster. And over time, these organs developed until they were able to create powered, sustained flight like birds.
Right.
So why haven't fish gone there? Why are there no fish birds?
I know you can't help but think about this, especially when you look at you jumping and then gliding. Why not flying? Why have they not taken that next step? And then indeed, is that step even possible, right?
Uh-huh.
Because as you pointed out, so many of these examples of flight that we have, and certainly there are not that many, you can ultimately kind of look at flight as a rare adaptation, even though it has been tremendously successful for the organisms that have achieved it.
Uh-huh.
Because as vertebrates go, we've only seen three takes on flight. We've seen pterosaurian flight, we've seen avian flight, and we've seen, you know, bat flight.
Yeah.
And fish, so far as we know, unless there's some sort of fossil out there that we've yet to uncover, they've never crossed the threshold. And in all, when you take in all biology, you have a single extinct lineage and three extant clades: birds, bats, and also insects.
But even in these three extant examples of vertebrate flight, they are examples of convergent evolution. Not that, like the pterosaurs, the birds, and the bats didn't evolve from each other. They all independently achieved the mechanisms of flight.
That's right. They exploit the same physical properties, but they're all different solutions to the same problem. I was looking at this book by David E. Alexander and Stephen Vogel titled Nature's Flyers, Birds, Insects, and the Biomechanics of Flight. And they put it into context like this. Quote, although such convergent features may make two animals appear quite similar, the adaptations are only superficially similar and have fundamental differences. Fish are cold-blooded, scaly animals with gills, but porpoises are warm-blooded, smooth-skinned breathers of air. The point being that these are both not flight-based, but these are both sea creatures with similar forms at first glance, but they're, of course, very different organisms.
Right.
It continues, hummingbirds and bumblebees have almost identical wing beat patterns, but hummingbird wings are made of bone, muscle, and feathers. Bee wings are made of pleated membrane supported by stiff, hollow veins. And they point out, too, that technological evolution has produced several areas of convergence between flying animals and flying machines. Quote, the convergences were not intentional copies of mechanisms used by animals, but technological solutions to common challenges faced by all flyers.
So this would seem to indicate that there's no inherent reason you couldn't expect fish to evolve mechanisms like a bird's wings or like an insect's wings. They would just be, you know, fishier, basically.
Right.
They would be evolved from the equipment available to fish anatomy.
Well, the one place that my mind immediately went was, all right, so it seems like all these other examples are land creatures that take to gliding. So maybe dwelling on the land is an essential prerequisite to the sort of gliding that evolves into flight.
Yeah, that could certainly – like, do you need a runway in order mm-hmm. to evolve flight, or a solid runway or a high place to jump off of? Can you mm-hmm. just not really ever evolutionarily justify the evolution of propelled flight mechanisms if you always have to start from underwater?
Right. And maybe that does hold true of vertebrates. But then according to biologist Jim Martin – the possible exception is with insects. Flapping gills could have evolved into flight-capable wings as an aquatic in an aquatic environment, according to Martin. So,
okay.
Insects may have an out there, but maybe this prerequisite holds true with vertebrates. But the thing is, when you start asking this question, you also have to take it outside of fish too, because we could also ask the same thing about other gliding organisms, gliding snakes, lizards, the gliding squid, various gliding arboreal mammals, including lemurs. Why are there no flying lemurs?
Yeah.
Because certainly they're in the position where they're leaping out of trees, they're gliding a little. Why does that not develop into flight?
I guess the simplest explanation to me would just be a guess, but it would be that there's just not enough incentive for it.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe there's just no clear advantage,
yeah,
survival or reproduction advantage to fish remaining in the air for longer than it takes to glide a short distance. Because, you know, when you think about it, what really happens in the air? I mean, birds use the air to traverse between different locations of feeding and breeding and stuff like that. I suppose fish could do the same thing, but I don't know. Would they be more open to bird predation if they were to fly around in the air all the time?
Yeah.
It could just be that there's not enough reason for them to have this trait.
Yeah, it's the one thing to say, all right, why doesn't the flying fish just become a true flying organism? But you also have to provide the reason for it. How is that going to work? Is it really a benefit that's going to play out in evolution?
Yeah.
And so far, the answer seems to be no. Now, I do have to mention that this larger question of why do some lineages evolve into the sky and others not, it remains something of a mystery, and scientists have even looked to underlying molecular mechanisms. And there's a whole study of biological periodicity that gets into this. It gets really deep and complex, and has a lot of parallels in molecular concerns. So.
Huh.
It ends up being a deeper question than just why don't fish actually fly, but why do any number of
why
creatures
does anything
not fly?
Fly? Yeah. One more thing I probably should say. It may have been too obvious for us to mention, but of course there is the impediment of breathing.
Oh, yes.
Right? You know,
yeah.
Fish have gills. But
have land. Again,
right.
Back to the mud skippers and the uh-huh. walking catfish, this and earlier forms of lungfish. So that alone doesn't seem like it would be an eliminating factor, but it would certainly still be a concern because they are venturing outside of their realm.
Yeah.
All right. So there you have it. We only covered some of the jumping fish out there in the world, so we may have missed some examples that you're particularly fond of or some just examples you've seen in real life and have some stories related to.
Yeah, and one thing I do think we should make clear is that, Robert, you and I, we're not trying to be alarmists about fish jumping. We have covered several stories of fish jumping into boats, fish jumping into people, and injuries that have been sustained on those accounts. But I think these events are exceedingly rare overall. So
yeah.
You really don't need to be like super worried about getting killed by a jumping fish.
Right. But certainly if there's a sign telling you not to drive too fast on the water because there are leaping sturgeon, I would acknowledge that sign and remember that, yes, individuals have been injured or killed. So
yeah.
Be cautious.
Honor the sturgeon.
Honor the sturgeon, indeed. All right. So, hey, if you want to check out more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all of our podcast episodes, as well as links out to various social media accounts, such as, Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook. And, hey, if you follow us on Facebook, make sure you click it so that we show up in your feed immediately.
Oh, yeah? How do they do that?
There's an option there at the top, like a star or something.
Yeah?
I don't have it in front of me. But it's doable. It's very doable. And you should do it because you never know how Facebook's going to tweak that algorithm and make it to where the things that you love, such as us, no longer show up.
Oh, yeah. We would love it if the majority of commenters on our Facebook posts were actual podcast listeners. That would be awesome.
We do have a few randos that wander in. Yes.
Yeah.
And hey, if you want to get in touch with us the old-fashioned way, how can they do it? How can they fling that mackerel into our boat?
Well, you can always email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations, prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to a Cross Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.